It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Starting today, the Pentagon must allow transgender individuals to join the U.S. military if certain conditions are met and a doctor certifies that the individual has completed medical transition and are in stable condition. The U.S. military was forced to comply with a federal court order last month that goes into effect today. This is just one of the four high-profile court cases in the wake of a dictate from the White House reversing an Obama-era decision to allow transgender troops to serve openly in the military. Last summer, President Trump weighed in on the issue in a series of tweets. After consultation with my generals and military experts, please be advised that the U.S. government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. Our military must be focused on decisive and overwhelming victory and cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgender in the military would entail. Thank you. Those tweets from President Trump resulted in several high-profile lawsuits and protests outside the White House from transgender veterans and supporters. Today's decision does not change the status of those transgender troops already serving. There are other cases pertaining to them, Leland, that are winding their way through the courts and are likely to go all the way to the Supreme Court at some point. In the meantime, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis has ordered a commission to review the impact of transgender troops on unit cohesion, and Mattis will report to the president on its findings on March 23rd. The Justice Department has decided not to appeal a recent stay ordered by the courts. Quote, the Department of Defense has announced that it will be releasing an independent study of these issues in the coming weeks. So rather than litigate this interim appeal before that occurs, the administration has decided to wait for DOD's study and will continue to defend the president's lawful authority in district court in the meantime.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. That was Jennifer Griffin on Fox News, and that report she gave at the very first of 2018, the very first day we were back from the New Year's. That's the day that transgenders were allowed to join up into the military, contrary to President Trump's stated wishes back in the summer. Remember, it was an Obama directive that started all of this from Ash Carter. They decided at the last minute before Obama was out of office that they would allow transgender soldiers in the military. I don't think that any of us thought this would actually ever happen. I really don't. And so here it is. And under the Trump administration, it's still going forward. How can that be? Elaine Donnelly is the president and founder of the Center for Military Readiness. No one knows more about this than Elaine, and I've asked her to join us this morning so that we can clarify what's going on and see if there's anything that we can do to stop it. Elaine, thanks for joining me today.
Yes, good morning, Sandy. Yes, it's a complicated story, but it's also very simple to understand. We have federal judges running our military now, and this is wrong. The Department of Defense, I think, should do better in protecting the prerogatives of the Commander-in-Chief, President Trump. Yes, he issued tweets, but tweets do not make policy. There was a formal memorandum that President Trump signed indicating his intent to end the policies that were put in place by President Obama, his predecessor, after a sufficient study was done about certain issues, such as what to do about transgenders already in the military. Trump said very reasonably, let's do a study and find out. But he also said he did not want defense dollars used for transgender surgeries, attempting to change gender, even though that's impossible. And he also said that he would not continue the Obama policy of admitting new people into the military who suffer from gender dysphoria, confusion about gender, people who identify themselves as transgender. So those three points in his memorandum went to the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of Defense set up a so-called panel of experts to look at this issue. Now, here's where the problems begin. Jennifer Griffin, in a later report, mentioned something that I had told to her, that this panel of experts is being headed by an Obama holdover, a man named Anthony Curta. Now, Curta, a high-level Pentagon official, had an LGBT pride event at the Pentagon, even without presidential authority. He's been in league with the LGBT activist groups. He helped to write the 2016 RAND report that was totally pro-transgenders in the military and full of flaws in terms of costs and consequences. This man has no business advising the Secretary of Defense, much less the President, but he is there. And he was not only not fired after that LGBT pride event, he was promoted. So there's a problem right there. We don't know why the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Mattis, has allowed this. Secondly, we don't know why the Secretary of Defense is not mandated that if we have to sign contracts with people who are confused about gender identity going into the military, if we have to do this under a force of a court order, why not say in the contract, this contract is being extended under a court order, you must understand that if in the at the end of litigation the government prevails, this contract may very well be voided. Okay, that way, even though the president has to do what the court is ordering, we're not recommending that he defy the court, he retains the option to revisit that contract and void it and implement new policy after the completion of all this litigation goes forward. Now, this is something the Department of Defense knows how to do. It's nothing new or unusual, but we have no explanation for why that was not done. We also don't have an explanation for why Department of Justice did not appeal directly to the United States Supreme Court when the appeal document that they filed, and it was rather well written, I might add, they appealed the initial decision by the district court. They went to the courts of appeals in Washington, D.C. and the Fourth Circuit. Those two courts of appeals turned them down. And then there's one more option. You go to the Supreme Court. The Chief Justice, John Roberts, is in charge of those two circuit courts. And that means that he alone, Chief Justice Roberts, could have issued a stay. And a stay would have been very justified because why have one policy and then perhaps change it later? Without that stay, all the gears are grinding forward. And here we have a spectacle of Pentagon officials issuing a memorandum about what type of underwear people who are confused about gender identity or going through supposed transition, what sort of underwear they should wear depending on whether they've had surgery or not. Now, I'm not making this up. This was reported in Military Times. It's in the form of a 7-page memorandum. Okay, so if you go to our webpage, 3ws.cmrlink.org, and look under the news releases, you'll see a reference to that, the documents involved that are in progress. Yes, there is a legal kabuki dance. You have to comply with court orders. We understand that. But both the Department of Defense and the Department of Justice could and still should do more to protect the prerogatives, not just the Commander-in-Chief, but also Congress. Only the President and Congress get to make policy. Judges have zero power to make policy for the military. But we have these four district judges. They're pretending to be supreme judicial commanders of the military with medals pinned on their black robes. This is ridiculous. But it's being allowed to go forward. And frankly, President Trump needs to ask some tough questions.
Elaine, let's talk about the letter that you and Ed Meese, a former Attorney General, commander of the Pacific Fleet, former Admiral Ace Lyons, General Jerry Boykin, General Tom McInerney, Frank Gaffney, and you signed this letter to the president. And the point of the points that you make is, I think, a point that needs to be fleshed out. And that is, you mentioned it, but let's flesh it out. If judges are allowed to overcome the wishes of the commander-in-chief in regard to who can serve in the military, what are the implications of that?
Well, it means that judges run the military, especially on issues perceived to be matters of social justice, okay? The courts in these four cases, the district judges, elevated the transgender plaintiff's case to the level of heightened scrutiny. Now, that's important because it's never been done before. They did not have any justification for doing that because under rational basis review, certainly there is a rational reason to say that people who have physical or psychological conditions that would render them non-deployable for long periods of time, that those people should not be eligible for the armed forces. They can serve their country in other ways, but not everybody is eligible to serve. There is a long list of physical and psychological conditions that render a person ineligible to serve. But the transgender faction is demanding special treatment, not equal treatment, equal opportunity. They're demanding special treatment. They're saying we should be allowed to join, even though, millions of dollars would have to be expended for surgeries, multiple surgeries, time off for what is called real life experience, RLE. The Pentagon has an acronym for everything, as long as a year off time, off duty, to go and figure out whether they want to go through transition or not. We have mandates, and we analyzed them, my organization did last year, from the Obama administration, saying that doctors and nurses, if they see ethical or religious conviction problems with these kinds of treatments, there's no option to forego being involved in all this. There's no protections for them. There's no protection for, say, women who don't want biological males in their private spaces, shower rooms and the like. There's no protections for women. It seems that the MEPS document I mentioned earlier, there's more concern about the personnel at the entrance processing center than there is for military people who have to live long-term with persons who are of the biological opposite sex.
Elaine,
kind of tragic because even if you undergo surgery, according to many experts, it doesn't reduce the high risk of suicide. People who are confused about gender identity deserve compassion. They deserve competent medical care, not politicized medical care. And
you know,
certainly,
Elaine,
not at the expense of the Department of Defense.
To the point that you made just prior to this one, I got a set of guidelines from a listener who's in the Air Force. And I was just reading through this, and I just, to make something, flesh something out that you mentioned, let me read to you what they say here. For a transitioning employee, this means that once the employee has begun working in the gender that reflects the employee's gender identity, agencies should allow access to restrooms and, if provided to other employees, locker room facilities consistent with the employee's gender identity. Transitioning employees should not be required to have undergone or to provide proof of any particular medical procedure, including gender reassignment, in order to have access to facilities designated for use by a particular gender. Now, this guideline is coming. It came to the Air Force from the U.S. Office of Personnel Management. That's why the language is not military. But the practical application, Elaine, as I have to say, is that the problem we're having in culture is that now people who are serving the military are being forced to share locker rooms, changing facilities, bathrooms. That in itself is horrific, and that's certainly...
Well, it's something that, as you know, it's been enormously controversial in the civilian world. Parents and even people who consider themselves on the liberal side of the spectrum are saying, wait a minute, my daughter is not going to have to be exposed to a person, a biological male of any age. A lot of people have said, we're not going to put up with this. Is it controversial? Has there been pushback? Have big corporations boycotted entire states like North Carolina? Yes, all of that is happening, but it's worse in the military. The reason is, if you work for an employer who is into this kind of a cultural thing, you can always change your job. You can go somewhere else. You can even go to another state, another school system. But in the military, you don't have a choice. Once you sign up, you must serve under the conditions that are mandated for you. So, and this is especially hurtful, again, to medical personnel, doctors, nurses, chaplains, people who have a problem with all this. For whatever deeply held reason, there is no provision for them. The Obama administration mandates are being carried over into the Trump administration. The courts are driving it. The Trump administration needs to start pushing back in two ways. They need to appeal to the Supreme Court, where I think their chances of prevailing would be very good. They filed good briefs so far, but the litigation hasn't even gotten into the factual stage. They're only talking about standing and ripeness and all of these legal terms. They haven't even gotten into the facts of the matter. But they need to go there. They need to hold off on all this stuff until the litigation gets into latter stages and it's finally resolved. And one thing that the Department of Defense should do, and they didn't need a letter from us to do it. They should have done it on their own. They should have issued conditional contracts saying very simply, we have to do this under court order. Litigation may change the policy, and this contract may very well be voided. At that point, the person involved would not be able to say, well, nobody told me. This is unfair. This president has every right to change the policies of Barack Obama. If you read the briefs extended by the court, not the briefs, the orders, these orders drip with prejudice against this president and animosity toward everything he's trying to do. They're very biased orders. But they have not even been compared to factual arguments. They haven't been challenged in a way that the Department of Defense has had a chance to present a case in favor of returning to the policy prior to Barack Obama. All the DOD is doing right now is saying, look, we're gonna freeze everything. We're going to keep it as it was under Obama until we have a chance for review. It was very reasonable, even going further than I would have liked, the August 25th memorandum. But the court is saying, no, this president doesn't have any say. President Obama, he has all the power. All his military was more wise than the military today because this military is subject to orders from this president, this commander-in-chief. And there is an element of disrespect there that is quite deep-seated.
Okay, so
but
Elaine,
that's the way judges are, and they need to be challenged.
Yes, so, all right. So the first ask is that Justice Department under Donald Trump go back and ask for a stay of the lower court rulings. But the second thing I think you're requesting is that the president issue a new directive that would at least in the interim supersede the last one and get past these lower court decisions. And let me just say that AFA
Well, actually, the president, the directive should come from the Secretary of Defense, and the president can certainly direct the Department of Defense to preserve his legal prerogatives. And I might add the prerogatives of Congress, because both Congress and the president have been shoved aside by activist judges who think they have the power to run the military, and they don't. Read Article 3 of the Constitution. There's not one word there about judges running the military. Power is shared between the Congress and the president, Articles 1 and 2. This is a constitutional crisis matter.
Yeah, it is.
And it's right now the judges are prevailing.
Yes, and let me just say, on a practical note, American Family Association has a petition that you can sign. If you go to AFA.net, AFA.net, we are collecting signatures to send to the White House to encourage the president to do the right thing on this. We think that he's inclined to do the right thing. He's already shown that. So we're giving him practical suggestions. So go to AFA.net and add your signature. Elaine, I want to say one more thing because I think we need to. I think it would be good to make it even more clear that if the courts prevail on this, any soldier can appeal to a court at any time, say, I don't think it's fair that I be sent into battle for this reason.
Yeah.
I don't want to fight this war. I don't want to, you know, the possibilities are endless. And that just should help people to understand why chaos will ensue if courts can make these kinds of decisions.
Well, that's right. Conceivably, any military issue could be subject to court review. And this is why, in their wisdom, the Founding Fathers did not give power to decide military issues to the judiciary. In fact, there is a Supreme Court decision with very specific language saying this branch of government is least qualified to make decisions for the military. So we have a long string of precedents to rely upon here. But for some reason, we don't know why. The Department of Justice decided not to seek that emergency stay from the United States Supreme Court.
Is it too late?
I think there was a big mistake.
Is it too late?
It can indeed be remedied, but there's got to be a lot of public pressure. And President Trump is the commander-in-chief. He has the right to insist that this be done. The White House counsel, the chief of staff of the president, there's a whole host of officials who I think over the holidays could have done a better job to protect the options of the president.
All right, so it's AFA.net, AFA.net, to sign that petition that we're going to send to the president. Elaine, we only have a few minutes left here, but if it's possible, you know, I've watched, just as a media person, I've watched what's gone on in the Pentagon, covered tons of stories. It was amazing to me how far south it went in terms of policy, politically correct policy, during the 8 years of Obama. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the stranglehold on the Pentagon is just almost unbreakable, including Secretary of Defense Mattis.
That's right. It's most unfortunate. And yes, I've seen it close up. We're celebrating our 25th anniversary as an organization this year. The reason the military is so vulnerable to social change is because everyone must follow orders. It's the strength of the military. It's also the greatest weakness of the military. Because when you get a president who doesn't understand that the military is there to defend the country, when you have a president who believes the military should be used to implement and force social change, knowing that whatever the military does will carry over into the civilian world, the military is very vulnerable. So when President Obama said at the very tail end of his term, this is the way it's going to be, everything changed, and the military said, okay, we'll tell you how we're going to implement your orders. That's how the military operates. It's, again, it's both its greatest strength and weakness. It's an institution that is vulnerable. And that's why it's up to civilians to say to the commander-in-chief, we have civilian control of the military. Look, that means every person listening to this program, if you vote, if you're a citizen, you have a stake in this because it's the only military we have. And this commander-in-chief certainly has a mandate to do what he said he would do, eliminate political correctness in the military. He was very clear about that. The Republican platform was very clear. Do a study first and then eliminate policies that interfere with mission readiness and combat lethality. The Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, a lot of respect for this man, but I've got to tell you, he is not doing anything to reverse the previous policies when it comes to the LGBT law that was imposed on the military back in 2010. If he really cared about this issue, he would not have put an LGBT-friendly official in charge of his so-called panel of experts. We don't expect anything other than a pro-transgender report from this man. Even if it has some good parts in it, it'll be overwhelmed by media coverage on what the media wants to report. I don't understand why the Secretary of Defense did not immediately mandate, okay, if we have to follow a court order, we're going to do it with conditional contracts. That should have been an easy one to figure out. It hasn't been done yet. Yes, we attempted to tug on the sleeve of the high-level officials over the holidays and say, look, why aren't you doing this? And it was very frustrating. Of course, it's hard to reach people over the holidays, but I think the holdovers in the Pentagon were very shrewd in saying, well, let's make the policy change happen on January 1. When the crystal ball comes down in New York City, nobody's going to be watching. Nobody will be able to stop it. And that's pretty much what happened. It's exactly what we predicted would happen. So we've got our work cut out for us. It's going to be a multi-stage pushback. We need to at least preserve the prerogatives of the president and Congress. Initially, we need to appeal to the United States Supreme Court. And then individual experts who really know this issue very well.
All right.
Need to be invited to speak and testify and do all the rest.
Okay, Elaine Donnelly, she's the president and founder of the Center for Military Readiness. By the way, it's cmrlink.org, cmrlink.org for all of her great information. And if you'd like to sign our petition, it's afa.net. And I hope you will. Go to afa.net and please sign that petition that we can get to the president and do something about this. Elaine, thank you for your time. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
It is absolutely huge.
Transgender men and women can now openly join the military. However, they must pass strict physical, medical, and mental conditions before they can become recruits. For example, a person must meet all the physical requirements associated with their preferred gender. Also, anyone receiving hormone therapy can be disqualified if they have not been emotionally stable for 18 months. Despite these guidelines, transgender individuals who did not serve openly are excited about today.
Any organization that doesn't embrace diversity will soon find itself, they're going to be obsolete.
But their future is still unclear. The Trump administration is still trying to ban the transgender community from the military, despite several courts ruling against it. These veterans praise those courts. They say turning away people who want to serve just because of their gender preference,
that's absolutely wrong, and it's a disservice to our military and the protection on this country.
They hope those who do enlist will be treated with dignity and respect.
When we have the highest ranking person in the United States saying that we are less than, what we're doing is we're setting an environment for a bully attitude.
All right, that's a report from KOAT. That was Megan Cruz, and that was out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can see that some people are actually very happy that the court stopped the president's directive that transgender should not be allowed in the military. We just spent a long time with Elaine Donnelly talking about the military aspect of this, but I want to get more personal with it now and reintroduce to you a friend of mine who has a lot to say about this and has standing to discuss it. Walt Heyer has 73 years of firsthand knowledge. It started when he was 4 years old with gender dysphoria and gender change. He struggled with gender dysphoria for 38 years. He underwent surgery, complete surgery, from being born a man to transitioning surgically into a woman. He lived the life of a woman for 8 years. Then he successfully had another surgery to bring him back to his real gender, which was male. He's lived as a man now, because he is a man, for 25 years. He's been married for 20 years. And he joins us today from out in the Golden West. Walt Heyer, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on today.
Walt, you heard that report. I mean, they said things like that we need to embrace diversity. We are turning away. It was a disservice to our military. We're discriminating against people if we don't allow transgendered persons in the military. What do you say to that?
Well, first off, the military is not a place to develop sex change surgeries and accommodate people who have these transgender ideologies. And what people really need to know is that the research shows that 62% or more of the people who identify as a transgender person are suffering from psychological comorbid disorders that have not been diagnosed and therefore not been treated. There's another element. What we've known for many, many years is that 41% of them will attempt suicide. Another statistic is that, according to the UK Guardian 2004 David Batty study, 20% of them will have regret. Now, the questions that the Pentagon needs to answer, are they willing to perform a detransition surgery after somebody has regret and put back all the parts and pay for putting back all the parts when they've taken them off at military expense? Also, what are they going to do with the people who attempt suicide? Obviously, those people are struggling emotionally, psychologically, and perhaps even with psychiatric issues. So, we've got this group of people who present a great number of very difficult issues. They're presenting far more issues than anyone else who would be entering the military. So I have advocated that if we're going to spend this kind of money to help people with surgery and their emotional issues and all this other the military wants to do, why don't we spend it on the veterans who've been serving and who need help in our hospitals today, who are waiting for care? We're discarding them. Those are the ones who are being cheated by spending money on transgender people who have very serious issues to deal with.
Well, of course, not to mention the fact that the military is all about fighting and making our country safe. It's not about restoring people. I mean, there was a time, you know, if you had a club foot, if you didn't have the right color eyes, you couldn't fly a plane, or if you were colorblind, you couldn't. There were all kinds of things that, asthma, lots of things that disqualify you from serving. So it's pretty astounding, really, Walt, when you think about it, that they would actually be recruiting now people who have such a complicated problem, and one that, according to what they are asking for, they would be able to completely transition from one sex to another. They would be given, I believe it's a year to transition, or at least 6 months, where they wouldn't have to serve. It's really astounding. The cost of surgery, too, can you just address that? Because it's not just one surgery.
Right. It's multiple surgeries. And then you have to kind of evaluate, is there going to be a limit on the number of surgeries they're going to allow the people to have? I mean, there's been, there was one transgender who was known for setting a Guinness Book of World Records. He had 167 transgender surgeries. Mm. So what is the military going to do? Are they going to set a limit and say, no, you can't have the facial surgery, you can't have the Adam's apple surgery, you can't have some other surgery? And what happens when they start lobbying to get all the surgeries they want? Where's the limits they're going to put on this? We're trying to fabricate a gender that doesn't exist, except in the minds of the individuals who, in most cases, have real deep issues, whether they're social adjustment issues, whether they're, you know, there's a thing called autogynephilia, which is a sexual fetish that a large percentage of people who identify as a transgender person have. What that issue is that just the idea of them dressing up in female clothes and looking at themselves in the mirror, they become the object of their own sexual affection. And so we've got a lot of issues here that I doubt very seriously that the military is adequately able to deal with. They're going to create themselves a great number of problems. Many of these people are not going to be fit to serve after they go through this transition surgery. It's difficult at best to deal with those transitions. And then what about the depression? I mean, these are a group of people who are deeply depressed, and changing genders does not fix depression. So it boggles my mind that as far back as 1978, at the Harry Benjamin Clinic in New York, a doctor who had worked with for 6 years administering hormones to people who changed genders, 500 people, in fact, he quit the practice because his words, not mine, there is too much unhappiness and too many suicides after changing genders. And he went on to say that the issues that transgenders suffer are far deeper than a gender surgery can deal with. So it's a very complicated, very difficult issue. It's a very real issue, but it's not an issue that should be placed upon the military to deal with. That's where we're going wrong. This is a definite psychiatric, emotional, or sexual fetish issue that should not be placed upon the military. The military is supposed to be a lean, mean fighting machine that goes out and kills people.
Yes.
Period.
Would you, some people who are lobbying for this would say, look, transgendered persons, there's nothing wrong with the way they can fight. They can fight just as well as the next person. Well, would you argue with that, Walt?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. When you look at the number of people who are suffering psychologically and emotionally from issues like dissociative disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, bipolar disorder, many of these issues don't manifest themselves until after they've undergone the gender change. So the evaluation process is quite often flawed. They can't deal and actually uncover the comorbidities that exist in this population. I found in 100% of the people that I've worked with for 10 years now that they can identify after they have regret and after they've had surgery what the onset of their gender dysphoria is. And I think it's important to note not one of them was ever born transgender. The only group of people that are born with ambiguous genitalia are not transgenders. Those are intersex, and not one of them is a transgender person.
That's really fascinating. I mean, not the last part, the last thing that you said. I mean, obviously, we know that some people are born biologically with both sets of organs, very tiny percentage, and that isn't what we're talking about. But the last part that you said, none of them I don't know exactly how that works out, if they identify with one gender or another, but that's a whole different issue. But that is not what transgendered persons are. They're born with, equipped with whatever God made them with, that DNA. And so, and now you talk, let me just go back to this point, because in terms of just expense, you estimate that the surgery can be up to $130,000 per person, but it's very interesting that you should add that where are the limits on these surgeries? So, it's just an inordinate expense. It's just amazing that at this time in our country, when we are struggling, our military, our fighting force is down. Our military vessels are down. Our planes don't have supplies, the parts that they need, that the Pentagon would be focusing on this issue. Elaine Donnelly told us, as a matter of fact, Walt, that there is a 7-page document just on how to handle the issue of underwear for transgendered soldiers.
Oh, my word. Oh.
So
yeah,
can
you imagine, I mean, that we're spending all this resources on cutting off genitalia and giving hormones to people when we have equipment that won't fly, people who are in hospitals that need medical care, and we're spending all our time and resources on trying to change genders. I mean, it's insanity.
Well, let's go back to something that you said earlier. You said 41%. Is this of transgendered persons just in general or post-surgery, that it's 41% attempt suicide?
Well, before and after surgery, there is very little change in people's psychological well-being. The study that was done by the UK Guardian, which is not a right-wing organization at all, they did a study of 100 different groups that have dealt with transgender people, and they said after the surgical procedure, after all the protocols, the people are still deeply distressed to the point of suicide after. So this whole line of discussion that the LGBT and advocates talk about if they have surgery, they're fine, is absolutely fraudulent.
You said that in that study, Daily Mail, I think you said, they said 20% have regrets. Now, you work with transgendered persons all the time. You have a blog, you have a web page, and you interact with them all the time, Walt. I should say that you're a very prolific writer. You've been counseling for all these years. Would you, just your gut, I realize this is not scientific, but do you really think only 20% have regrets?
No. No, because that if we're to be intelligent about this and have an intellectual discussion, 41% of the people who attempt suicide are regretters. Because I don't know anybody, and I doubt that you do or anyone listening to my voice today that knows anybody that's happy with their life that's trying to end it. They're trying to end it because they regret their life. So if you add the 41% into the regret number of 20%, then you have 60% of the people who say they're transgender or identify as a transgender person are attempting suicide or have regret. That's huge. And why would the military be spending all their time and resources on trying to set people up and put them in the military when they're likely going to have depression, anxiety, attempted suicide, and regret having done it? What's the military going to do then? They're on the hook for their medical care after that? I have no idea what the costs are going to be. The individual who had 167 surgeries spent $225,000 on surgery. So they're going to be lobbied. If they dig into this and say, yes, we can have transgenders in the military, the next thing that we're going to be discussing on the phone on your radio show is, well, Can they have nose surgery? Can they have ear surgery? Can they have this surgery, that surgery? So where does it end? Because they could, each one of them could have multiple surgeries to try to look like the opposite gender when they aren't. So
you know what's,
they're digging themselves a deep hole.
And they're not, you know, the interesting thing always is, Walt, that it's certainly transgendered persons are behind this, but not really. It's like the left is so hell-bent on pushing the most radical kind of sexual behavior and mainstreaming it. Not enough to just allow it, but to make people embrace and call it normal. They did that with homosexuality, they did it with gay marriage, and now they're doing with transgenderism. I don't quite understand that drive. I do sort of, but I'd love to hear what your take on that is. Why are they so impassioned to mainstream all of this?
Well, they're trying to mainstream it because this is a political issue. It's not a medical issue. It's never been proven. They haven't yet 1 ounce of evidence that surgery is medically necessary. The only person it's medically necessary for is the doctors who are getting paid to do it. It's not medically necessary for the individual to prevent him from suicide because he's still going to attempt suicide if he's inclined that way. So what we have is this group of people who don't benefit from this, but the political people do benefit greatly because the more arguments there is about this, the more fundraising they do. And then you can just look at George Soros, who keeps funding this. This is part of this whole operation is George Soros. I doubt that we would have the power that the LGBT has today void of George Soros. He is a great funder of this, along with many other people, but Soros is certainly the engine running this machine.
Well, and we have to say, without getting on too much of a tangent, that when you get in the deep weeds with the left, and going back to Marxism, and before that, it was chaos, and certainly the breakdown of the family, a complete sexual anarchy. That's what they've always advocated. So it's really in keeping with that, even though people don't recognize it. And of course, it's painted as being kind to people, open to diversity, embracing, welcoming, giving them equal opportunity. It's all painted as such a positive thing when it really is a damning thing to them. And that brings me back to what you do. Walt, let me just say that Walt is an author and a speaker, and I want to give him your website, and then I want you to respond. Walt's website is sexchangeregret.com. Sexchangeregret.com. And his website, which is, one's your blog. Your blog is walthire.com. Walthire.com. Yeah. So, Walt, what were you going to say?
Well, I kind of forgot what I was going to say.
Well, then let me ask you a question. When we talked last, you had some very interesting stories about what people were sharing on your blog and on your website. What are you seeing as a trend among people discussing this issue? What's happening now?
What's happening now is that the predominant thing happening is detransitions. People want help to detransition. I am working now at where I used to get maybe one a month. Now I'm getting about three, maybe four people a week asking for help to detransition. These are people who've had their genitalia removed, and they want to know where to go, how to get help, how to restore their life. So this is the new trend in the transgender movement. It's not transitioning. People are moving away from transitioning, and even California, as an example, has now made it possible for you to transition without surgery. So I'm not sure why the military is willing to spend money when California says you don't need to spend any money on it. Many other states are just allowing people to change genders without surgery, without hormones, and certainly, if that's done, the detransition process is much easier. However, none of these people are appropriate, in my view, to be in the military. They need to. I think it does a great disservice to the individual who says he's a transgender person to put him in a military environment. I think that is highly stressful. As much as they would like to normalize their life, and I totally understand that, that is such a high-stress environment. I would not be surprised, given the fact that people who aren't transgender in the military already have high rates of suicide attempts, that we will see this 41% attempted suicide rate among transgenders could be elevated up to 60 or 65% for those in the military, because the stress of being in the military is far greater than in a normal social environment.
Walt, I've shared this with you, but I don't expect you to remember. I had a very dear friend who I knew his wife and family, I mean, for years. And he shocked me to death by announcing that he was first a cross-dresser and then started taking hormones. And we had a very kind of confrontation, spiritual confrontation. And he changed his mind. He was a Christian at the time, and he confessed to his church, stopped taking hormones, went back to his family. I mean, back to them, not physically. He never left the home, but returned to his fathering and being the man that he was made. And then he changed his mind and went through the incomplete transition. And I've watched things in his family go off the rails. I've watched it. It's so sad, Walt. And so when I tried to get help for him, I was told by, and I'm telling you, I've been in radio for years and in ministry for years. I know so many people who should have some answers. I found none at that time. None. Zero help. I had pastors tell me, counselors, there's no hope for this. Once a person, it's like an obsession. You can't help them. Your testimony that that's not true. And what would you say in these last few minutes? Can you transition? Can you be whole again, being the person, the sex that God made you?
Yes. Yeah, you can detransition. It is not innate. It is not required to have surgery. It is not fixed, mutable. It is absolutely a psychological, emotional, psychiatric, or sexual issue that with proper, effective treatment, you can be restored and redeemed to the gender that you left. You have to commit to it. You have to be willing to stay the course. There are deep psychological issues that need to be addressed. And the people that I've worked with, and it takes a while for them to admit it, confess to me that they've either been sexually abused by a neighbor kid. One gal had her dad had her engaging in lesbian sex with her sister, and he watched. A lot of these people went through some very horrible events early in life. And if it didn't happen in the house, it happened somewhere outside of the house. So it takes a long time for people to admit that they've been sexually abused, physically abused, emotionally damaged, or they had some horrific event happen in their life, a suicide by a parent. Things happen. And one of them was passed around from home to home because the parents had died and just never found any stability. And I think what's important for us to understand is that a person who identifies as a transgender person does not like who they are and are trying to find someone within them that they actually like. And so changing genders is a temporary reprieve at best in trying that process.
Walt, we are running out of time, but I want to also say that in the course of this, I know because I know your story that you became a Christian and that was a huge factor in your change too. I want you to know that there are two articles that Walt has written, one for Heritage Foundation's Daily Signal. I was once transgender, and he writes from there, and also in Newsweek, What I Wish I'd Known Before Undergoing Sex Reassignment Surgery. And last but not least, if you would like to get the message to the president to stop transgender serving in the military, a way that he can do this still, go to AFA.net, and sign our petition, and we will get it to President Trump. Walt Heyer, it's always a pleasure. God bless you and all that you do, and sustain and keep you, and give my very best to your beautiful wife.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.